So a friend of mine, Joanna Bush, who's, you know, she's like an art director, you know, illustrator, she, you know, works on the production design world. She's worked with Ang Lee before. And what's so great to hear is that he's just one of the nicest guys in the world.
Good.
And, you know, I was just like, oh, man, that's great to hear. Because
he seems like
it. He seems like it.
But yeah.
It's like sometimes you hear those stories and you're like, yeah, never mind. But
I watched a Charlie Rose interview with him and he just seemed like a very sweet individual and very much in love with his craft. And you could tell that he really enjoys doing what he does.
No, totally, totally.
I'm Brian Foster, and this is the Grindhouse Institute. On each episode of this podcast, Jeremy Floyd and I program a triple feature movie night. Each of the movies share common themes, and we discuss them here. We're happy you could join us for today's block we call Stressful Thanksgivings. With the holidays quickly approaching, the Grindhouse team thought it was best to celebrate Turkey Day in the best way we know how, by watching a trio of disquieting films, of course. The movies in this block each present their own version of holiday tension, and all are quite different. However, they all have incredible all-star casts and revolve around Thanksgiving. Realizing his love for Lee during a family Thanksgiving dinner, Elliot will do anything in his power to be with her. The only problem is that Elliot is married to Hannah, Lee's sister, who was once married to Mickey, who may be interested in Holly, also Hannah's sister, who he already went on a disastrous date with years ago. Oh, and Lee is dating Frederick, but has feelings for Elliot. Everybody got that? Mia Farrow, Diane Wiest, and Barbara Hershey are Hannah and her sisters from 1986. Amidst the backdrop of the Watergate scandal and an oncoming ice storm, the town of New Canaan, Connecticut rides out the Thanksgiving weekend with pastimes like infidelity, shoplifting, drug abuse, sexual experimentation, and, well, key parties. Kevin Kline, Sigourney Weaver, Christina Ricci, and many more star in Ang Lee's The Ice Storm from 1997. After their daughters disappear on Thanksgiving, two families try to help the police with their complicated investigation, but are they doing more harm than good? Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal head up a killer ensemble cast in Denis Villeneuve's Prisoners from 2013. Thank you for listening to the Grindhouse Institute. Please enjoy.
Oh, for God's sake, Kelly, get the hell in here.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a toast. You know, this beautiful Thanksgiving dinner was all prepared by Hannah.
Well, it's great that we can all be together. And this Thanksgiving, no yelling, no hysteria, especially with your grandpa not here, although we miss him. So let's do it right. And Wendy, why don't you say grace?
Dear Lord, thank you for this Thanksgiving holiday and for all the material possessions that we have and enjoy and for letting us white people kill all the Indians and steal their tribal lands and stuff ourselves like pigs, even though children in Asia are being napalmed. Okay.
Jesus, enough, all right.
All right, welcome back to the Grindhouse Institute. I'm Brian Foster, and with me as always is Jeremy Floyd. Hello, and how are you?
Doing well. I finally found a reason to live, and it's the Marx Brothers. Any world that can produce the Marx Brothers is one I want to live in.
Fantastic. Oh, today we are talking Stressful Thanksgivings, which I have been tickled about the title of this episode for a long time. We're going to be talking about three films, I guess, of varying degrees of stressfulness and different types of stress. We've got Hannah and Her Sisters from 1986, The Ice Storm from 1997, and Prisoners from 2013. These films, I don't know if they could be any more different from each other.
Yeah.
but definitely I get why we picked this as a Thanksgiving stress, as that's kind of the background of all these, or at least the start of some. But yeah. This was quite an interesting one and quite a heart-pounding trilogy, if you will, especially with Prisoners, but this was great.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't go for full-on lighthearted comedy, I think the only other way to do Thanksgiving is stressful.
Go the exact opposite direction, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess Hannah and Her Sisters is a funny movie, though.
It's really funny. It is like stressful at times. You know, there's just a lot of stuff going on there. But also, I think, you know, you were saying that these movies are very, very different from one another, and that is very true. I think the only other way other than Thanksgiving that they all feel similar is like they're sort of ensemble casts, and they're like, you know, there are sort of no unknown actors in any of these parts.
No.
It's incredible.
I mean, even in Hannah and Her Sisters in small bit parts, you've got John Turturro and Julia Louis-Dreyfus that just show up out of nowhere, you know.
Carrie Fisher, Daniel Stern,
Julie Kavner.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's the smallest part, but Max von Sydow.
He's hilarious.
Steals the show for the 5 minutes he's on screen.
I should have married you earlier. He's wonderful.
If Jesus saw what people were doing to his name, he would never stop throwing up.
I'm not going to sell my art by the square foot.
Right. I don't sell it by the yard.
By the yard, yeah. I just love that Daniel Stern comes in there kind of hot-headed, rich kid, something from New York, probably some broker, just wants big art. Yeah. He doesn't care what it is, he just wants big art.
Like, supposedly he was like a rock star or something.
That's exactly.
Yeah, it's funny.
I'm looking for something big.
Big. Frederick, show him the oils.
They're all in the basement.
Frederick's done this whole new series that I'm sure you would really love.
Are they big?
Yeah, some of them are very big.
Because I got a lot of wall space there.
I don't sell my work by the yard.
Frederick.
I think it's interesting, you know, okay, so these are very, very different films, and I think in sort of tone and the gravity of the stressfulness, they're all very different, but also very much in sort of the film form, all of them take on this very, very, like, distinct look from one another. I mean, like, you know, in some of our other pairings, I mean, the way that, let's say, all the buddy cop movies that we watched, for instance, you know, it's like, they all have a very similar feel, you know, it's just a different gradation of, is it more funny or more, you know, serious. And in this one, like the way that the stories are being told and like, you know, the way that, the filmmaking is being conducted is just so different in all of them.
Well, I think that's fully attributed to the directors, in question here. You know, you've got Ang Lee, who obviously has a distinct visual style that seems consistent throughout his films.
Right.
Woody Allen's films obviously have they are Woody Allen films. No one else is making those kinds of films. And I'd argue that Denis Villeneuve also is now, in my opinion, a master filmmaker. And you know, his films also have a visual style or a tonal style. And I think that each one of these are so individual to the director and to the storytellers that were, you know, crafting these pieces of art. This is just a great block. Have I mentioned how much I like this block?
I like this block.
I like this Duke.
Really, really did enjoy all three of these films. First time seeing. I thought I'd seen Prisoners before. I had never not seen Prisoners before. This was the first time, and man.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Talk about a stressful Thanksgiving. I mean, poor people. Yeah. I mean, we can go in order of movies, okay. But I figured, you know, I just needed to bring that up.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's fine. Let's go in order. But then like, I mean, it is interesting. I thought you said you'd seen it, but,
yeah, I did.
I'm glad, you got to check it out finally though.
God, she's beautiful. She's got the prettiest eyes. Stop it, you idiot. She's your wife's sister.
Let's start with Hannah and Her Sisters. I already brought up the cast, or you brought up the cast, and I had already said that when I saw her on screen, I wasn't sure if it was her, because we were watching it at our mutual friend there.
We should actually say we actually got to see this one projected in 35 at the Patrick Cady movie theater in his backyard.
Beautiful.
This movie... I guess Prisoners was taking place in what was supposed to be 2013, but it feels kind of like a period piece for some reason.
Really? That's interesting. Like a 90s period piece?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, like, I feel like the phones that people have...
The old cell phones?
...weren't what people had in 2013.
Interesting.
Maybe that was part of it. You know, because, whatever, by, yeah, somewhere in there that the 2010, 2011-ish, you know, it seemed like everybody had a smartphone by that point.
And also, I guess that wouldn't really have much impact other than the ability to search on your phone, you know? Like, right. I don't know, like the functionality or level of functionality.
The only thing I was going to say about that was just like, the other two movies kind of felt like period pieces. And this one, Hannah and Her Sisters was a contemporary movie. Like, so in 1986, they were supposed to be taking place in roughly 1986. And yeah, that viewing experience and seeing it on film actually lent to that pretty well.
It felt like I was in just a small theater similar to the New Bev or something like that, where,
yeah, right,
you know, there needed to be real changes. So there were, you know, yeah, brief pauses in between, you know, certain bits of, because that first reel went for quite a long time. And then those other two were just super quick, you know, but right, it was right, interesting to see how all that stuff is formatted, you know, for the reels and what they look like. And to see that in person gave such a different type of appreciation for the entire experience. Plus, you guys were there, and it was nice to be in around people, hearing, yeah, people laugh at a movie, except my own cackle. Right. I'm tired of hearing myself laugh, right, at jokes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, and laughter's infectious, and so you get that audience experience.
Exactly.
You know, his setup is interesting because he's got this projector that, you know, he can sort of splice two reels together, you know, to make fewer real changes. But, you know, in a projector in an actual theater, like the New Bev or whatever, you know, they'd have them on these platters so that, and they have dual projectors set up so that at the real change, you'd be able to, you know, move over it seamlessly. Yeah. And then have to like pause for everyone to, you know, run to the lobby or whatever.
Oh, I've seen Inglourious Bastards. I know how it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen Fight Club, okay. I know the cigarette burn.
Boop.
In the industry, we call them cigarette burns.
Yeah, there's something about that format to watch a Woody Allen film on. Plus, to be totally frank, I haven't watched many Woody Allen films. I always had an odd issue with Woody Allen. Always, because I think that by the time that I started understanding who Woody Allen was, he had already started going through some of the controversial issues that he's been dealing with in his personal life. So I do have to say it's kind of hard to, you know, like praise somebody like that, but it's undeniable how good his films actually are, and like how he can keep so much clearly that must be mostly improvised going on screen. Especially with that first, like, we get that Aaron Sorkin walk and talk at the beginning when he's in the studio.
Oh, right.
And he's with the other writers, and he's trying to figure out the show. Yeah. Why are they taking this episode or this segment out? Why are they taking these lines out?
Mickey, listen, we better go right to Ronnie's dressing room. This kid must have taken 1,600 quaaludes. I don't think he's going to be able to do the show.
Why me, Lord? What did I... You stand in the practices? Yeah. Okay. Why all of a sudden is the sketch dirty?
Child molestation is a touchy subject with the affiliates.
Read the papers. Half the country's doing
it. Yes, but you name names.
We don't name names. We say the Pope.
We always
that
say
that sketch cannot go on the air.
Hey! Who changed my sketch about the PLO?
How he moves in between these things and all these scenes and his, like, neuroticism and thing. It's just everything kind of comes together, and it's really brilliant, the filmmaking.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you probably started with a good one then. I mean, I feel like most people, if they are watching the first Woody Allen film, it'll probably be Annie Hall, maybe.
Yeah, I've never seen Annie Hall. The only one I saw was Mighty Aphrodite.
Okay, yeah.
Which was okay, which was a good movie. I like it.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
And one day my friend Susie calls me, and she asked me if I want to be in a film, something called Snatch Happy. And I said, sure. And I was very nervous because I'd never done it in front of people with a camera before, you know? And so there I am on the first day on the set, and there's this guy fucking me from behind, right? And there's these two huge guys dressed like cops in my mouth at the same time. And I remember thinking to myself, I like acting.
The way that he uses the camera is interesting, because it's like, you know, there'll be moments like the one you're talking about there with the walk and talk and sort of the 30 Rock behind the scenes of whatever the
right, yeah,
you know,
exactly,
live variety show that he's putting on.
Yeah, not SNL. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The not SNL show that they're working on there.
Right.
You know, and then like all the chaos that's like surrounding, we're going on air in 25 minutes or whatever. And the camera then reflects that, and it's really frantic, right? And then, like, you know, then you'll see a lot of these other scenes where, you know, the camera sort of doesn't move, and it just kind of, you know, we'll sit in that wide shot in the corner while everyone's eating Thanksgiving, and, you know, Hannah's explaining how she went back to doing plays, and then she, you know, get that out of her system, and now she's gonna go back to being a mother and all this stuff. And in those moments, like, the camera's like as sort of far back as it can be, and then we'll see things like, I think the opening shot is Michael Caine's perspective of him staring at Barbara Hershey from across the room,
And it's his voiceover over, like, just thinking about all that, yeah.
Right.
The first time she ever walked past me with that perfume, you know, and he's yeah. like, I was going to swoon, and you see him in real life just yeah. kind of swooning at her.
Right, and then it cuts to, like, him, you know, we're seeing literally what he's thinking.
Right.
Yeah, so it's really interesting how, I guess in certain ways, like, the camera's very reserved in this. I think just the opposite would be something like Prisoners, where mm-hmm. you know it's you know it's constantly sort of moving and making every shot of Rembrandt. But in this one,
is that
like
Roger Deakins,
yeah, Roger Deakins. Yeah, but also just like the little things, like in Prisoners, like right after the girls first run out of the house and everyone's just got done eating, they're all like hanging out, like you know trying to stay awake off of tryptophan and wine, and we're experiencing the passage of time, and the way we show that is we go outside of the house and there's just like the slow creepy push in on the trunk of a tree.
Oh right.
And you know it's very unsettling, but also you know slightly unmotivated, you know, you know it's
yeah
it's definitely this like style piece versus you know the like all the like functional ways the camera's used in Hannah and Her Sisters, like
yeah, more like a documentary camera in Hannah and Her Sisters. We're just capturing the life of these people.
Yeah, or it's like you know every time the camera moves or every time that there's a close up or whatever that like it's there's a lot more sort of I don't know how you say it, like there's
intention.
There's a lot more purpose, like or there's, yeah. there's a lot more he's holding back and then giving you those things when you need them. And like
Woody
and
Allen, as you mean?
Yeah, and then you're able to like play everything else sort of in the wide.
Interesting. Yeah, and that's a good way to look at it.
And I think a great example of that is that scene you were just talking about, where it's like Michael Caine brings Daniel Stern over to look at Max von Sydow's art. They go off. You know, Max and Daniel go off into the basement to look at other paintings, and then Michael Caine and Barbara Hershey sit down and have this innocuous conversation, and all the while you're sort of hearing his voiceover, and he's like, "I'm going to be really subtle. I'm going to do this the right way. I'm just you know, just tease it out there. Just see, get to dip a toe in the water." And then like you know, all of a sudden they're the only two in the frame, and he just like grabs her and starts kissing her, and she's like, "What's going
nothing,
on?" Yeah.
Nothing subtle about it.
Yeah. Right, and it's like
yeah,
the camera has sort of had to move to get into that position to then you know get the gag to work.
Okay, yeah. Ask her if you can see her for lunch or a drink tomorrow. And be ready to make light of the offer if she's unresponsive. This has to be done very skillfully and very diplomatically.
Did you ever read this one? Lee, I don't!
Lee, I'm in love with you.
Well, I think that I wanted to go back to that pre-show, that studio scene. I really love that scene. A lot of the lines in that scene were really funny too, and you gotta watch this thing more than once if you want to catch everything. It's right. So fast. I mean, Woody Allen, very very funny individual, but he was just like, you know, does anyone have whatever medicine it was, because his ulcer was acting up. Wow, my ulcer's acting up, and the one actor that they're trying to get to work because he can't work because he ate a drugstore, I think is the way that Woody Allen said. He goes, "What'd you do, swallow a drugstore?"
Right.
Instead of the child molestation sketch, why don't we repeat the Cardinal Spellman Ronald Reagan homosexual dance number?
Well, I don't feel good, Mickey.
Yeah, what did you do, swallow a drugstore?
Look at this guy. I lost my voice.
Oh, Ronnie, Jesus. Ronnie, you know, you do have to go on in 25 minutes.
Has anybody got a tag of meth? My ulcer's starting to kill me.
You want a Quaalude?
The one that really got me going was the, so, you know, Woody Allen plays this hypochondriac who, you know, thinks he has a brain tumor at one point.
Because his ear was ringing.
Because his ear was ringing, and like, in you know, he is constantly going to the doctor to find out what's wrong, even though there's nothing wrong, and like, the doctor is like jaded, and he's like, yeah, what is it this time? But then, you know, there's this possibility that perhaps it's something serious. And so he spends the weekend like, you know, like, yeah, like just completely out of his mind. And like, you know, and he's trying to find meaning in life, and he's, you know, going to different religions or whatever. And he like, he's trying to join the Catholic Church, and like, and like, you know, I can't remember what the setup was, but he's talking to the priest, and they're like, well, what, is there any reason why you couldn't join the faith or whatever? And it, like, cuts to his mom, like, screaming and fainting or whatever in the next room. And, like, and again, that scene, I think, was very similar, where it's, like, it was just that shot down the hallway and people kept walking in and out of the scene. And anyway, Woody Allen's dad is, like, you know, he's Woody Allen's grilling him about, like, well, what, life is meaningless because X, Y, and Z. And he's, like, how do you explain this? How do you explain that? He's, like, I don't know. What do I know? I don't know anything.
Of course there's a God, you idiot. Don't believe in God.
But if there's a God, then why is there so much evil in the world? Well, just on a simplistic level, why were there Nazis?
Tell him, Max.
How the hell do I know why there were Nazis? I don't know how the can opener works.
Oh my God, it's so good.
Yeah, the hypochondriac thing kind of just keeps coming back. And he goes to his doctor, and one of these lines stuck with me, and I had to write them down. He was like, I've got a pain in my ear. And the doctor's like, well, which one? He goes, oh, my left one. Oh, probably my right one. Yeah. Well, it might be my left one, though. I'm not really sure. And then he's like, well, are you hearing ringing or buzzing? And he's like, yeah. And, you know, now you say it, I'm hearing a little buzzing and ringing and a little ringing and buzzing, too, you know? And he's like, well, you're hearing it in both ears? And he's like, why? Is it healthier if I've got an infection in both? He's
like, yeah, is it better if I just have it in one or something?
And then they go into that montage of all those little tests that they're doing, you know, like ringing the tone bell. And then Richard Jenkins is the guy that tells him, he's like, he went to him for a second opinion, and he's just on the phone, you know, talking to him. He's like, well, the worst case scenario is you have a brain tumor. And that's when shit just ends for him.
If you have a hearing loss in one ear, and it's not from a virus or a loud noise or anything, what are the possibilities?
Anything. Often it's hereditary, flu. Even a small noise will do it.
Right, but nothing worse.
Well, yes, I guess the dark side of the spectrum is brain tumor.
Really?
Yeah, what's funny is I was thinking about it. In sort of all of these cases, and all three of these movies, the sort of recounting some of the events in the movie are so complicated. Like, what's happening and who's doing what to whom, and, you know, it's like, who's related to one another. You know, especially in this one, because, you know, in the ice storm, it's essentially two families.
Right.
And that helps simplify it in some sense. In this one, I guess it's, you know, around Hannah's family, which kind of simplifies it in a way. But, like, you know, there's just, like, so much going on with, you know, Max von Sydow and, you know, the Diane Wiest character and, you know, Barbara Hershey, Michael Caine, that whole thing, like.
Well, even when you watch the trailer of it and they're like starring, boom, and they put like 10 names up there at once, and they're all like big names.
Yeah. Right, exactly. I mean, that essentially could have been it for any of these movies. I mean, you know, at the time with the ice storm, Tobey Maguire hadn't done, you know, like Spider-Man yet, or in...
Or Elijah Wood, or...
Yeah, Elijah Wood hadn't done, you know, Lord of the Rings or whatever yet. Or like in... Prisoners, Viola Davis, you know, hadn't become, you know, the name above the title.
Brilliant.
She was kind of a character actor still at the time.
Holy cow, did she steal that movie.
But it's like, you know, and same with, I don't know what, maybe David Dasmalchian.
Yeah.
Everyone in that movie is like sort of recognizable. And part of it is that they're more recognizable now than maybe they were when it came out. And, you know, that's what I would say about Hannah and Sisters, like the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character that was on there for 2 seconds. Lewis Black, who was also part of that entourage running around with Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Come on, yeah. Yeah. I think it's that big New York stand-up comedian crew, right, to get them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, New York staple, and anybody who's working in New York would probably, you know, get cast in one of his movies at some point.
Right.
Doing one a year or two a year for whatever that was. 60 years.
I'm blown away by how he can make just mundane shit though cinematic.
No, exactly, and I think in this case, like, I think what helps sell that feeling is just sort of the way the movie comes together. And I thought, you know, okay, we were describing those reel changes earlier when we were getting toward the end of his, you know, religious crisis and, you know, brain tumor crisis and all these things. And we see him again, and he's, like, running into Diane Wiest in the record store. I was like, wait a minute, did we miss something in The Real Change where he watched the Marx Brothers? Because, like, you know, I was like waiting for that and like didn't realize that he, or I forgot anyway, that he told that as a sort of flashback to Diane Wiest later on. But, you know, in that scene in particular, sort of resolving his, you know, crisis there where he's like, he's totally given up on life. Life is completely meaningless. It's a total void. There's no reason to be here. And he had was holding a shotgun to his forehead. And it was, you know, in this nervous, nebbishy fashion, you know, it was like, you know, about to pull the trigger. You know, apparently the sweat on his forehead was so much that the gun slipped and, like, you know, shot the mirror behind him or whatever.
All of a sudden, the gun went off. I had been so tense, my finger had squeezed the trigger inadvertently. But I was perspiring so much, the gun had slid off my forehead and missed me.
And then he wanders around. He was very shooketh from the experience, and then wanders around, you know, New York for hours, and, you know, wanders into a revival house that was, he didn't know what was playing, and he sat down in the middle of duck soup and, you know, decided that life's worth living because the Marx Brothers are hilarious.
And I wandered for a long time on the Upper West Side, you know, and it must have been hours. You know, my feet hurt, my head was pounding, and I had to sit down. I went into a movie house. I didn't know what was playing or anything. I just needed a moment to gather my thoughts and be logical and put the world back into rational perspective.
Like most of these movies, like, you know, Thanksgiving is just kind of the setting, and it's an excuse for all of these people to be together. And in Hannah and Her Sisters, it's sort of no different. However, the movie takes place over the course of like 3 years, essentially. And Thanksgiving is the touchstone on all three of those moments.
Really interesting way to break up the film.
Right. And it's an interesting way to, like, I don't know, show time's passing, but also like that it's an interesting way to structure it. Cause like, I don't know, it's so rare to structure a movie around Thanksgiving like this.
But it makes sense. And it kind of goes back to what I was saying about him making mundane stuff look cinematic or feel cinematic, because right. In a lot of families, the only time they get together is the Thanksgiving holiday, yeah, or the Christmas holiday. So it makes sense in real life, and it just makes sense in this movie because,
right, exactly.
You know, there's a lot of things. I just watched something recently. It's called Midnight Mass. It was a series on Netflix. Uh-huh. And there was something where they had to write in a way that for everyone to gather into one spot, but throughout the entire show, mm-hmm, you know, certain groups of people could not go there, would not go there. And so they had to write it in. And I thought that was interesting because it reminded me of the formats of these, at least of Hannah and Her Sisters, that,
yeah,
that was the only way that you could write everyone together realistically, you know, as opposed to, oh, I was just passing by and I decided to come in, you know, or, yep, oh, did you drop this the other day? You know, like one of those right, kind of
exactly,
things.
Exactly.
At least they wrote it in, you know.
No, that's a good point. And in those scenes, like, you also kind of see, because you see Thanksgiving so often in this movie, like, you kind of see how everybody, you know, sort of changes throughout those times. And, you know, when Maureen O'Sullivan and Lloyd Nolan are, you know, going at it, you know, almost coming to blows or whatever, they're just like yelling at each other and, you know, going nuts and talking about the old times and, you know, how each one was cheating on the other.
Yeah, like, I'm surprised, yeah, this is even my son or whatever. Yeah, he's like, yeah, with all the guys you've been with.
It's a good thing we had a talented daughter.
I can only hope that she was mine. With you as her mother, her father could be anybody in Actors Equity.
Yeah, and what's great is like how at a fever pitch that scene starts, and then by the end, you know, he just goes off to calm himself down in the other room and plays piano. And she comes down the hallway and starts kind of like singing along with him, or whatever. And like, right, you know, and that's how they sort of make up.
Remember this, Hannah?
And I also, I mean, one last scene I wanted to talk about on this one was like that, again, that sort of tonal shift that he does so well, like that when Barbara Hershey comes home and is ready to like break up with Max von Sydow, he's like talking her ear off about how he was like flipping around the television all night long or whatever because he was, yeah, he was bored and, you know, watching all this like stupid shit. And like, you know, he delivers this like really, really funny, extremely long monologue.
It's been ages since I sat in front of the TV, just changing channels to find something. You see, the whole culture. Nazis, deodorant salesmen, wrestlers, beauty contest, the talk show. Can you imagine the level of a mind that watches wrestling? Huh? But the worst are the fundamentalist preachers, third-rate con men telling the poor suckers that watch them that they speak for Jesus and to please send in money. Money, money, money. If Jesus came back and saw what's going on in his name, he'd never stop throwing up.
At the end of it, he's like, well, why aren't you talking to me? What's wrong? What's going on? And he gets it out of her that she's leaving and breaking up with him. And then, like, it turns into this breakup scene.
I have to leave. I have to move out.
Why?
Because I have to.
What are you going to use for money?
I don't know. I thought maybe I'd move in with my parents for a while.
I always told you you would leave me. Say, does it have to be now?
Well, maybe it'll only be temporary, but I have to try.
You're my whole world. Good God. Have you been kissed tonight?
No.
Oh, yes, you have. You've been with
Stop
someone.
Stop accusing me.
And, you know, and then it's just like, it's completely heart-wrenching. Like, when he just, like, collapses from, you know, the regret of, like, not marrying her earlier. Or
right,
whatever
yeah, that's what he was saying. Yeah.
And, you know, to think of, like, where it started, it was just, like, really hilarious too, like, you know, the sort of stressful ending,
right?
You know, he just like balances those things so well.
Yeah, I think it's just masterfully writing scenes, right? I mean, yeah. they all could sit on their own as a complete story, you know.
Yeah,
they all have
yeah.
a beginning, middle, and end.
Right.
In issue number 141 of the Fantastic Four, published in November 1973, Reed Richards has to use his anti-matter weapon on his own son, who Annihilus has turned into a human atom bomb. It was a typical predicament for the Fantastic Four because they weren't like other superheroes. They were more like a family. And the more power they had, the more harm they could do to each other without even knowing it.
Let's move on to the Ice Storm from 1997.
Yeah.
From
Speaking
in
of
in
stressful family.
Connecticut. Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear when that guy said that at the beginning?
Yeah.
And over here
New Canaan, Connecticut.
New Canaan, Connecticut.
I guess that's another thing. Sorry, real quick. I guess that's another thing that kind of ties some of these movies together. Is like they're all, you know, very East Coast movies. But you know, the, you know, town everything's happening in becomes kind of a character in all of them. You know, it's like, you know, New York is a very big part of the, you know, another character in Hannah and Her Sisters, Ice Storm, the New Canaan, and I guess for one scene, New York City,
right?
But,
yeah,
and then you know,
East Coast, Connecticut, Pennsylvania was
Amish country, right in between Pittsburgh and Philly, and Prisoners,
right?
You know, that, you know, sort of wooded area, it was definitely heavily felt in the movie.
Yeah, and the Ice Storm was no exception to that. First of all, Ang Lee, another brilliant filmmaker here that we've got here on the show. Thanks for joining us, Ang. Yeah,
thanks, Ang.
It was very interesting to see this film, especially from an Asian director filming a movie very much about American history.
Are you watching this?
Watching what?
Nixon, doofus. It's incredible. He should be shot.
Hey, drop the political assassination stuff, please.
I was puzzling about that Watergate thing for a while. It's like, you know, so this is, I think, before Nixon stepped down, but it's like, you know, in the buildup, just the long slog of like every day, you know, something new is happening on the in the saga. But I was like, okay, well, they're putting a lot of emphasis on that. It's not just like, you know, they're watching anything on TV, that this seemed to be a thematic thing. And I was like, well, I wonder what it meant. And I think part of it was supposed to be that, like, the, you know, Watergate, I feel like for a lot of people, you know, changed the perception on how some of these things exist in the imagination. And it's like, you know, oh, the presidency is this hallowed institution, and, you know, we all must respect the president's coming through. Even though I voted for the other guy, you know, this is this is America after all. And, you know, it's like, you know,
the curtain has been pulled off and the reveal has been made.
Curtain fell down and it turns out there's just nothing behind there. It's just empty. It's just like, you know, this void. There's like nothing there. And it's like, you know, all of that, like, so the you got the rug pulled out from under you or the curtain pulled off the stage, whatever the metaphor is.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, you're left in this spot of like, well, how do you make sense of this world that's now, you know, everything you thought was real just turned out to be a backdrop.
Do drugs and drink.
I think part of it is, do drugs, drink, hey, maybe we can fuck our way out of this. You know,
have a bunch of key parties with a bunch of your adult friends and throw a bunch of keys in a bowl.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, okay, it's like the kids, you know.
Same thing.
Like trying to experiment and, like, you know, figure out what's going on and exploring each other sexually and whatever. Like, that kind of made sense or whatever. They're in that stage where they're you know, doing those things, figuring that stuff out. But yeah, I think for the adults and like the key party and like, and how just sort of everyone in this small town
screwing each other
was down. And it was like,
how the hell are you going to keep that a secret? when you got Randall Flagg there waiting to get laid too.
Right. The walking dude.
I'm glad you caught that was Randall Flagg in the stand.
Oh my God. And then the guy, Kittredge, you've never seen
Kittredge.
Me very upset.
When that girl pulls his keys and he's like, all right, well, good night, everybody. But there were moments in this movie that were so comical, I guess, but at the same time, there was this really dark undertone for all of them. And, you know, there was a lot of tension in that room specifically, mostly between Kevin Klein and Sigourney Weaver. And that was because Sigourney Weaver at this point was over his shit being his
side piece.
He was more her side piece.
Exactly. He wanted to have like, I don't know, an emotional affair. And she was just wanting to get laid.
She's like, I'm already married. I don't need another husband here.
I don't want to take on your problems. Shut the fuck up.
Exactly. Yeah. This we're done.
Pick up your pants and get out of here.
And at the one point she left him in bed and just left him there. And that's, she never came back.
I waited around for more than half an hour, nothing but my boxer shorts.
When I remembered some chores I wanted to get done before the party, I just did them, that's all. Because I wanted to get them done before I saw Jimmy.
Jimmy?
I love how he's just like wandering around the house in his underwear. It reminded me of another Kevin Klein movie. A Fish Called Wanda, when John Cleese is wandering around.
Exactly, but it wasn't Kevin Klein,
You said you loved him!
That's right, Otto. Now here's a multiple choice question for you. A, Wanda was lying. B, Wanda was telling the truth. Which one are you going to pick?
What was the first one?
I think Christina Ricci embodies kind of like that parallel between like we were just talking about how the adults were in this like weird experimentation phase, and she was in that phase too, and she definitely led the charge of like the kids version of that. And I you know, it was kind of uncomfortable to watch her between Elijah Wood and
Tate.
So it was just hard. It was hard to watch kind of like those sexual scenes, especially with what in the movie are underage kids, and it was rough. But I think Ang Lee does a good job of creating, you know, something beautiful, something cinematic out of something that could be a little disheartening or disgusting to watch to some people.
I was thinking about that too. It's like, you know, I don't think a movie like this would get made. I mean, for multiple reasons now, because, you know, just these mid-budget movies just don't get made anymore. But like, also because of some of the subject matter with, like, you know, the young teenagers experimenting sexually and everything else. And it's like, you know, it's like, well, it's not sort of untrue. And, you know, like what's happening between them isn't predatory, or it's not like date rape or something like that. It's just, you know, it's uncomfortable to think about when you're an adult watching it or whatever, and in that situation. But it is also, you know, sort of like there's a lot to sort of puzzle over there with the Christina Ricci character. It's like, you know, she wanted to mess around with these kids in particular, their neighbors, and their brothers, and she kind of didn't care which one was which, and like
exactly.
And, you know, And she was way more into it than they were, than the guys, Elijah Wood or Little Man Tate. In fact, the younger brother, you know, chickened out when it came time to, you know, you show me yours, I'll show you mine.
Well, the first time,
doctor
though.
Or whatever. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and the second time he fell in love with her immediately.
Yeah.
He told her he loved her, and she's like, that's nice.
Yeah.
Felt bad for him. But what I don't understand between the two brothers was, I mean, and I don't understand this at all, and I was really hoping to bring it up on this show, was, and I'm going to spoil the ending for a 1997 film, but Elijah Wood's death at the end.
Yeah.
Why? And is it just a random event? Because it becomes quite almost religious like or biblical at the end, you know, the carrying of the body and the, you know, moving him from one side or one place to another.
Yeah, the like family learning that the son was dead. I feel like that scene was one of the weaker ones out of how and actually the actual death scene was also a little weak. Everything sort of leading up to it, I was really into, like, the
I was caught by surprise from this moment.
Oh man, I was too. And I okay, so part of it is like, okay, so it's Elijah, like Christina Ricci was like kept cornering Elijah Wood in these spaces and, you know, making him make out with her and, like, you know, almost you know, take his pants off and, you know, getting caught in some of these things. And then during the titular ice storm, they seem like they're gonna go rendezvous out in the woods or whatever, but she just comes over to his house and he goes around, you know, playing and jumping around on shit. You know, it's kind of like, you know, he still wants to be a kid and she can't grow up fast enough type of thing. It's like we keep seeing the, like, we keep cutting away to him and seeing what he's up to in between cutting to the, like, the key party and then, like, you know, the whatever Christina Ricci was up to and the little brother. And then, yeah, like most of the stuff, it seemed like it made sense to me. It's like, okay, you know, everything's super fucking slippery because of the ice. And so he's like, you know, sliding down the hill, just like on his butt. And, you know, he was jumping over some stuff and, like, doing all these things, like, where he's just, like, playing around in it. But then the one that was, like, insane was he was going up to a diving board on an empty pool.
Yeah.
And every step he took, like, it was like slip, slip, slip on a diving board. And it was like, oh my God. I mean, it almost made it feel like, you know, he didn't have his entire mental capacity. You know what I mean? It's like that was like, what the hell is he doing? It didn't even look fun. It didn't even look like,
no,
you know, fun, dangerous type of thing.
Right.
Like, oh, I'm going to climb too high and it's scary, but it's also fun. Like this one, it just seemed like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. Slip and break your neck in that,
like,
pool.
Like, it's as if he was, like, trying to die. Now, I don't think that's what was happening, but that's kind of what it almost seemed like. And then he, like, gets tired of, like, sliding around on his butt. He sits down on, what I don't know what those things are called, like the little guardrail.
I call it a guardrail, yeah.
Yeah. Sort of a, you know, metal guardrail to keep a car from going off the road.
Right.
And he's looking down the street, sees a telephone pole kind of crash or maybe a tree branch breaks the telephone pole.
Yep.
And a live wire is just, like, you know, like swirling on the ground below,
teasing
the
death.
He sits there and watches it. He's like, whoa, what's going on over there? And then it, like, you know, slowly boom hits the pole and he's like, well, that's weird. And then all of a sudden he's like, and what's strange is, so the camera doesn't stay on his face and, like, watch him go limp and die and have it, you know, have that sort of, you know, pathetic noise of, like, his life leaving him and, you know, kind of like, oh, geez, and make you feel uncomfortable that way. It plays it in this weird way where it's like the camera cuts to behind him and he, like, slumps, like, you hear the noise and he's, like, slumps off the side. And then we cut to this sort of three-quarter shot down the street, and his body's, like, sliding down face first.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the sort of suddenness of him dying, the fact that we were behind him, and his body sliding down, I started laughing really hard. It was, like...
Because it was visually strange. Yeah.
And also, like, he when he was, like, looking at the, live wire, like whipping around or whatever. Like, he looked like a, you know, Christmas Story when he's like, oh, fudge.
It's like, get the fuck out of there, bro.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, there was this, like, tragic element missing.
Yeah, I feel, I think, totally. I
think part of it was just the way it was covered. You know, if they had done sort of just the opposite, where, like, instead of being behind him in sort of a, you know, in a close, but, like, or being across the street and being in front of him, and, you know, being a super wide and just watching him die and then slide, it would probably feel a lot less comic because it would just be kind of still and like in clinical.
Right. Because you don't see him slip. You don't see him slip in the first shot that he dies. Right. If you see the whole thing, then you kind of put the pieces together, as opposed to, it seems like he died. Someone took him, pushed him face down into the ice and slid him down. You know what I mean? Like it was too choppy or something.
Yeah. Or it's like, okay, let's say you can't do that stunt and have it work in the.
Then
in
don't
the,
write it.
And
don't write it.
And playing all in one like that, like it's not practical or something. If you're gonna do it in pieces, like the way they did it, okay. Let's see his face. Let's see the life go away and have it not be funny that way.
Yeah.
And like, you know, see that lifeless face hit the ground or something before we see that shot of him sliding face first. I mean, without any context, the sliding face first, without that sort of added context, the sliding face first comes off as hilarious.
That looked fun.
As opposed
not jumping on the icy diving board, but slipping face first in some ice. That looks pretty dope. I would do that, you know? I agree. I was kind of pulled out at that moment. Like, I feel like the last, like, 5 minutes of the movie kind of just took it out of me. But I love the rest of it.
Yeah, I was definitely into the rest of it. And it was like, you know, because I was laughing so hard at that moment, it also like kind of took the wind out of some of the last part of it too, which,
right,
you know, it was also played very awkwardly. It's like, you know, Kevin Klein sort of brings his body up on the porch there. The dad comes out after having awkward car sex with Kevin Klein's wife, Joan Allen. And like, you know, he comes out and his whole mind is blown and it, like, he's going through way too much really fast, and like he brings him back inside, and then everyone comes into the family and they all start getting hugs real quick, one by one, and then I think we're out, right? I mean, like, oh no, we go back to Tobey Maguire coming back on the frozen train, and then sees the like traumatized family at the platform waiting for him.
Oh, right.
And that's where we end.
Eek.
So stressful Thanksgiving. Yeah. But
no, but say, it's not like we're leaving a good note to go on to a nice heartwarming film either.
Yeah. I suppose my reluctance was the group aspect of it. I've never been much of a joiner, although I still consider myself a somewhat religious person.
Well, I, of course, flatter myself that our church is not exactly what most people would call organized religion. At times, it's the disorganization that's liberating. And of course, I've begun to minister much more in what one might call therapeutic environments, in small groups and couples and one-on-one.
Part of it is the whole time Joan Allen knows that Kevin Klein is banging the neighbor, Sigourney Weaver.
And Dana Barrett.
And she swears there was something in her fridge and the eggs were cooking on themselves on the countertop.
I heard a voice say Zool. It was right here.
And when she reached into the bowl of keys, she didn't ask, are you the key master?
Well, that's great. Either I have a monster in my kitchen or I'm completely crazy.
I don't think you're crazy.
Oh, good. That makes me feel so much better.
Before we sort of learn that Joan Allen knows all these things, we see her like sort of in this quaint small town, rummaging through you know, what looks like kind of a garage sale or, you know, maybe a flea market or something. And she gets stopped by some guy who
beautiful hair.
He's got this beautiful mane, and it's like, you know, he's got this long Professor flowing jacket. Locks, but his like hair part starts, you know, like a millimeter above his ear. He talks to her about, like, oh, remember last year came by my cult, and you didn't stick around, right? But I thought you were great, and blah blah blah. But it's funny because, like, you know, he was just like the least convincing cult leader in history. It's
is
like,
that what we were supposed to get out of him?
That's what it sounded like. I mean, everything about him was like, we've got the new church where, you know,
we can
fuck anyone and whatever he was talking about.
That's what it was, yeah.
And it sounded like some, you know, new age, you know, kind of Charles Manson style, you know, cult shit.
Jonestown.
But unlike Jonestown or any of these other cult leaders where they've got the gift of convincing people, this guy just is like, he's all smarm and no charm. Like, he's got that on his business card.
Sometimes the shepherd needs the company of the sheep.
I'm going to try hard not to understand the implications of that.
Forgive me.
And then I love the scene, or I don't know, the parallel scene with Christina Ricci and Jonah Allen at different times going and like robbing that pharmacy or whatever to like feel alive. Yeah. And I feel like that, too, is a part of the whole, you know, Nixon key party, you know, the fuck our way out of this thing, where it's like
escapism, or let's do something. Let's be a good person trying to be bad, yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah. Or it's like, you know, let's do something to feel alive, like steal.
Yeah.
Or maybe let's do something to feel alive, like stand on a fucking icy diving board on an empty pool.
And then not die until you sit to take a rest.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's what we're missing, is that was just totally symbolic by the end. And, you know, it was just...
Right, that everyone there had some sort of, like, I don't know, it's kind of a type of death drive, I guess. Like, you know, the way that they tried to feel alive was by, you know, doing dangerous things or, you know, doing taboo things or whatever. And, you know, the whole town got caught up in it, even though mostly figures around these two families who happen to live just up the way a spell from each other.
Well, speaking of two families, should we move on to the two families and prisoners who have to deal with some awful things on Thanksgiving evening?
We certainly shall.
Okay, so first of all, I know I said before that I had seen this. I thought I did. I might have gotten this confused with something else. This is my favorite Denis Villeneuve film now, by far. By far.
Okay.
Absolutely. I think
even more than Enemy, huh?
I think this and Enemy are very close, first and second for me.
Was it because they have such different endings where it's just Jake Gyllenhaal's face cut to black?
They're both the same. Yeah. Wait, you don't get the spider as the last shot in Enemy? It's actually Jake Gyllenhaal's face.
No, you see his reaction to it.
Oh, okay.
And then it cuts. Cut to black, yeah.
I want to talk about Jake Gyllenhaal, first of all. He's incredible in this movie. I love this, the character that they built around him, Detective Loki.
Right.
I just think that's amazing. The whole art direction around this character, he had like runes as like tattoos on his fingers, if you see.
Right,
Shot of his knuckles.
And he's got the like Mason ring.
Who controls the British crown? Who keeps the metric system down? We do.
I think that this movie was first of all, I think Denis Villeneuve, again, working with Deakins is one of like the greatest combinations ever. Because, you know, I think Denis has an absolute vision, and I think the right person to deliver that vision is a great cinematographer, which we have. And the use of symbolism and the use of the mazes, the names, the tattoos, like the difference between Loki's character and the Dover character, and you know, it's they're kind of at odds of each other. However, they've kind of got the same mission. They just have to go about it two completely different ways. And the way that they presented that throughout this film, I thought was so well done.
It's interesting. I like you say that, but I think that wasn't the case. Like Loki was the only one trying to work this thing the right way. Like none of the other cops in his, including his captain or whatever, that, you know, guy is always like, fuck you. No, fuck you. And like, you know, hey, have a drink. Well, I think we're done here or whatever. And all that stuff. Like nobody wanted to solve this thing the right way. Certainly not Keller. Keller just grabbed the first suspect he saw and like went crazy over him. But Jake Gyllenhaal was being torn apart by not being able to like figure this thing out, and it was so complicated, and like there's so many ins and outs, and yes, obviously everyone wanted to have this crime solved, but what I mean is that like the only person sort of going about it in a way that could get anything positive as a result was the Jake Gyllenhaal character, I guess.
You don't think that just pulling the first suspect you come to, putting him into a trap that you built out of a bathroom in an abandoned apartment building, where you have it's just a random event where you get scalding hot water or freezing cold water get poured on you, and the only room you have is to sit down? Right. You don't think that that's the right route, that maybe Jake Gyllenhaal should have taken that route?
Yeah, no. Torturing the sort of special needs guy and, you know, turning his face into hamburger and, you know, going crazy. Like, obviously wasn't the way to go.
Paul Dano owned this role, and he wasn't given a whole lot in terms of like lines.
Mm-hmm.
But every time he was on screen, I felt both uneasy as well as...
Well, I mean, you felt sympathy for him.
Sympathy is the word I'm looking for, yeah.
You know, it's complicated, especially the first time you watch it. Like, you're not sure whether or not he's being played or not. Whether or not Hugh Jackman's being played by Paul Dano, that is. But the way that Paul Dano responds to everything, every single time, you know, it's like Jake Gyllenhaal was, you know, intimidating him in that interrogation room. And he was like, don't touch me. You know, he's like, you know, and he doesn't understand the questions and all these things, and then, you know, he gets these little moments where he expresses himself a little more clearly.
Like, she didn't start crying until, or they didn't start crying until I left.
Mm-hmm.
One of the lines where you get confused as to whether or not he's in on this against Hugh Jackman.
Right. And I think part of that was some misdirection, because it's mm-hmm. like one of these moments where he's finally saying something kind of clearly, but he's not talking about the thing that Hugh Jackman thinks he's talking about.
Right.
And a lot of those context issues, like sometimes when someone has trouble expressing themselves like that, that happens quite a bit, where it's like, you know, you can't quite puzzle out what they're going for all the time, because the context is all in their head, and their ability to express that doesn't match what's in there.
Mm. I don't recognize these girls.
I didn't see them. May I sit down?
What do you do in the RV? Answer my questions.
I sleep there.
You sleep in there? You were sleeping out there mm. during the day? Why was the RV parked outside the house?
I went for a drive.
You went for a drive? You weren't driving. I know for a fact those girls were playing outside your RV. You weren't driving. It was parked. Was it a special day? Were you planning on taking two little girls?
No.
Have you done that before?
No.
Did you ask him to come inside?
No.
You asked him to come inside the RV and then you take him away?
No.
And that was clearly what was happening with the Paul Dano character. Or, I shouldn't say clearly. It became clear right. that was what it was with the Paul Dano.
Over time, yeah.
And I guess I'll also walk back my Jake Gyllenhaal thing, too. It's like, you know, he cared a lot, and he was trying to do the right thing, and he didn't know which way was up, and everything was so complicated, and everything was so crazy. And, you know, he's like, suspect Hugh Jackman at one point, because, you know, he's like, what's going on with this guy? And then, you know, when he tries to give David Dasmalchian the business, well, that didn't end well.
No, it did not. That's a brutal, brutal scene.
It's pretty much
shocking.
Pretty much that describes every scene in this movie.
That's true.
Yeah. But I forgot how sort of complicated the plot was. Like, I feel like I had remembered a bunch of it, but watching it again was really interesting. And I feel like I understood it better, is what I was going to say. But I wonder if maybe I did understand it the previous time, but I've forgotten all the details type of thing.
Or are you looking at it from a newer perspective? You know, you have new experiences.
That could be too, yeah. Just sort of everywhere. It's like everywhere you look, like Melissa Leo was great. I mean, she was just like so captivating.
Amazing.
You know, and Terrence Howard like kept stealing every scene.
Viola Davis.
Viola Davis, like, and how he would do these things like that. Okay, so like I feel like at the time when this movie came out, it's like, okay, this is like kind of marketed as a thriller. And for a thriller, it's, you know, whatever, almost 2.5 hours, like 220 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty long. And, you know, I feel like at the time it got a lot of heat for being so long. And then also,
really,
for being a thriller, it's like people were probably expecting something more like Ransom.
You okay. Know,
the Mel Gibson movie.
This was far better than Ransom.
but what I mean is like that Ransom's kind of a popcorn movie. And, yeah, you know, exactly. It's not too heavy and, you know.
No, this is an Oscar movie we're talking about here, right?
Yeah. But
people didn't think that they were going into that.
Well, because it's like, it's not as sort of maybe mundane and like messy as one would expect from an Oscar bait type movie, where it's like, you know, it's just a straight drama and, you know, bad things happen sometimes and throw your hands up. I don't know. You know, in this one, there was a really complicated sort of thriller plot at the center of it. But it was that subject matter was taken very seriously. But, you know, this movie being marketed as a thriller, I think kind of, put it in that category of like, well, why isn't this any fun? Like, usually thrillers are fun, and this one is pretty heavy.
This one doesn't take any, doesn't give you any breaks, you know? Like,
right.
Even the ice storm, for being such a dark film, there's funny-ass moments, you know? I mean, Woody Allen's movie is funny.
yeah.
This one does not give you any levity whatsoever. Maybe the beginning Thanksgiving scene, when they're just setting up nice peacefulness before they drop the hammer on you, and these two girls are taken, and it's... From there, it is not a pleasant ride, but it's phenomenal.
Yeah, but it lets you know. I mean, even if you didn't know a single thing about this, which, I mean, it kind of sounds like you kind of walked into it in that sense where it's like
cold.
Yeah, totally cold. It's like that first time you see the camper, it's creepy.
Yeah,
and then the second time you see it, the kids are fucking with it, and you're like, well, this is no good. Even though, like, in between some of those moments, it's like the family. You know, chitting and chatting about what they're up to, and, you know, they're just messing around, like Terrence Howard playing that trumpet really terribly, and all these things, you know. But I like the opening scene is also so refreshing in a movie like this, where it's like you do get to know everybody a little bit, and you get a little you know, a taste for what everything was like beforehand.
Right.
Hugh Jackman is the sort of doomsday prepper guy, and he gives his son that speech in the beginning, and then later we see his, like, gas mask down in his like, survival basement and, like, batteries and...
How perfectly organized was that stuff? Like, I would love to be that organized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's almost as if a production designer put that together.
I saw a half-used bag of lye down there. Oh, we had to bury the dog.
Right. And what's funny is, like, you don't know if that's true or not. I mean,
exactly,
like,
yeah.
Obviously, like, we don't really see him use the lie on Paul Dano, so it's not as if that was the case. But
that was just to burn, right? Similar to what they do in Fight Club, right?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, maybe. Jesus.
Yeah.
There's a bag of lye in your basement. It's half empty. Your wife thinks you've been helping us, and we both know that's not true.
I used the lie to bury our dog last year. And helping the cops sounds better than I've been driving aimlessly in my truck because I don't know what the fuck else to do.
Is that what you're doing last Saturday night?
Probably. Am I a suspect?
No, no, I'm only asking. I'm only asking because you assaulted a man who's now missing.
I heard about that. What happened? I thought you had him under surveillance.
I'm going to assume that you're asking me because you have no idea.
Yeah, well, I didn't think it was something I could get away with.
It's not.
Couldn't be that he skipped down because the asshole was guilty. Or couldn't be that, right? Because that'd mean it'd be your fault, right?
What was exciting was that, like, that we spent that first 15, 20 minutes just, like, getting to know everybody, you know, and it's, okay, before we meet Jake Gyllenhaal, but, like, you know, we get a sense of the before, and we get a lot of after, you know, with poor Maria Bello, you know, just, like, pilled out and like sobbing in bed, and like
also one that steals this movie.
It's hard to say that. It's like everybody does it. Yeah.
Which I think that that's great writing. That's great direction. Everyone has their moment to shine, and everyone really does. I also think it's interesting that something we've brought up on other shows, Chekhov's gun. In this one, we had Chekhov's whistle, the red whistle.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, we see at the beginning that's established, and then at the end, that's kind of the call for help, or the sign of hope, if you will, just barely heard underneath the Trans Am and the, you know, that hole that's in the ground.
Right, right. You know what's funny? Like, I think the first time I watched it, I thought maybe that was like, I don't know, the wind somehow blowing through the whistle down there. Because it just seemed like so much time had passed and it was freezing and whatever else. I don't know. But
that
like,
he would be dead already, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
It's more like Schrodinger's cat down there. It's like, you know, the Schrodinger's Wolverine. Is he alive or dead? And we won't know until we open up the Trans Am hole.
What an interesting shift, right, by the end of the film, because the whole movie we're trying to find two girls that were kidnapped, and we find out through a twisty bunch of events that it's basically a family of kid kidnappers, and Paul Dano was actually one of those victims when he was a young boy.
Right, and so was David Dastmalchian, right?
They both were?
Right, right. That was the thing. It's like, and Melissa Leo mentions it toward the end there when she's Mr. Bonding Hugh Jackman into the Trans Am or whatever.
Yeah.
But essentially, Dastmalchian got away at one point. But, you know, the whole idea was that, I don't know, he was...
And that's why the mazes were stuck in his head?
So fixated on the mazes and, okay, like, the all the, like, punishment with the snakes and, like, the, you know, having to get the kids' clothes. Like, he was, like, breaking into their houses to, like, steal the clothes to, like, complete his, you know, his mental picture in those, like, locked...
He was harmless in a way, right? But obviously through all this confusion, he would be a top suspect.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's hard to explain what it is that he's doing there, and especially when he's so, you know, psychologically damaged and whatever else.
So we've got Paul Dano, who is special needs, clearly. I mean, that's the character. That's not ambiguous by any means. I would say the same for David Dastmalchian's character.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what about Jake Gyllenhaal's character? There's a lot of tics that he has. Mm-hmm. Like, he blinks really hard a bunch of times, and you'll see it over and over again that happens, and it's usually in a moment of great stress or like when something is, you know, pressing him. And I'm wondering if they were trying to hint at him kind of, because he's a loner, right? During all of this, his job seems to be the only thing that he's got in his life.
Yeah, we don't ever see him at home. He's only I don't know what, in the field. In this profession. It's like, you know, and in fact, I think the only scene where we really see him not on the job is the first time we meet him at the Chinese restaurant.
He's eating by
Thanksgiving
himself.
Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah,
by himself
at a Chinese restaurant. Like, there's a lot behind that, right? He's got no one. He's got no family. He doesn't have that.
Right. Right.
You know, but you know, now it's his mission to find these girls, and he doesn't even know about that mission yet. You know.
Right.
I mean, did you catch that at all with his character? I mean, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, And I wonder, okay, maybe part of that too is like, yeah, he just, you know, maybe he's somewhat on the spectrum or something. If he has no filter with like anyone he talks to. I mean, although that, maybe that's not true. He does try to keep himself under control around Hugh Jackman and the family and everybody. But like,
just let me do my job, sir. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Dover, I understand this is an incredibly hard time, but I have every uniformed police officer in this state looking for Anna.
They said he tried to get away. I don't understand why he would try to run away.
We're considering all possibilities, Mr. Dover. I hear what you're saying. I'm not crossing anybody off my list. Just let me do my job.
I kind of read the eye thing as like, well, it's just like how he processes stress. But I don't know if that's what they're going for or not. I mean, perhaps. I guess there's something there to read into it. I mean, the thing is, it's just that, yeah, like, unfortunately with his character, we're just missing a little bit of like what's going on with him. I mean, you know, obviously we know that this event is super stressful for him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, other than that, we don't know anything about him really. Except for that he's lonely, I guess.
Right, and they set up that stress so strongly by saying that he's a detective that literally has never lost a case. Every one of them has been, every perp has been caught, every case has been closed successfully, and this one is just driving him to the limits.
Right. Yeah, and I guess this one's no different, right? I mean, in the end.
Exactly, yeah.
He does solve it.
Even though your buddy there, Wayne Duvall, the captain there, who's trying to give him booze, and all right, dude, it's all right. We win some, lose some. It's like, yeah. Two girls, man. He's like, exactly. Fuck your sorries. You go tell the girls after Desmalkian blows his own head off, you know? It's like cold.
In detective fiction, it's always like there's like the driven detective who, you know, really gets obsessed with the case and wants to solve it. And then there's everyone else who's just punching a clock and it's like, what the hell is wrong with you? Why don't you go home? And, you know, there isn't really a home to go to, I guess, for the Jake Gyllenhaal character in this one.
An interesting answer that there were some extra features on this one. I actually ended up watching this one like on Amazon, and there was 15 or a 20 minute piece at the end, just like behind the scenes, some interviews. And Villeneuve is giving an interview, and he said that this movie could easily have taken place in more of an Old West setting as a Western. And it's almost as if the cowboy is trying to take the law into his own hands while the sheriff is out there trying to do things in more of a by-the-book way. And I think that really comes through after hearing that. It's like, oh, that'd be a very interesting Western.
Yeah, that's true. I guess in that sense, it's kind of, you know, that John Carpenter modeled after a Howard Hawks character type of thing, where it's like you get you know this character only in the context of their profession or whatever. But I'd say, other than maybe the sort of on the cop side, like with the two families here, the Hugh Jackman, Maria Bello, and Terrence Howard, Viola Davis characters, we do get a lot of moments with them, and even like the Hugh Jackman's son, you know, when he was like, you know, sort of waking up sobbing in his sister's room and all this stuff. And like, you know, we do like get all these quiet moments. And I think this like goes to what I was saying earlier about how we get to spend some time with the family before the ruckus started. We also don't forget about these scenes where it's like, you know, we see Viola Davis like microwaving turkey leftovers or whatever, and the microwave dings, and you know, she doesn't move, you know, and she's just like frozen. And you know, we see plenty of those moments with Hugh Jackman and what it is that he's up to, and of course Maria Bello's you know, medicating herself and all these other things. And what's nice is that he does play all these moments and have them, you know, able to breathe in a movie where you'd think the temptation would be to sort of cut that stuff down. Let's get to the thrilling parts of it again. Let's get to, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal beating up his desk and, you know,
right, you know, throwing his phone around,
solving crimes and yeah, talking to the CSI guy or whatever in David Dasmalkian's house or whatever. Like,
right,
that was another example of like a cop character that we saw who's just punching a clock, and he's like, yeah, how do you explain this? How do you explain that? And he's like, I don't know. Forget it.
Yeah, move on.
Yeah, move on.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I, you know, kind of appreciated how this movie straddled that, like, taking the drama seriously, but also, you know, pushing the thriller aspects of it. I mean, I know that, like, for Terrence Howard, a lot of it was him being weepy, and for Hugh Jackman, a lot of it was him just, you know, being 10 out of 10 angry. But that scene where like Terrence Howard hadn't told Viola Davis yet what was going on, and he comes back home, and like they're having that candlelight, the sort of neighborhood's having the candlelight vigil for him, and he like kind of, you know, breaks down and can't stand up, and he looks like he's about to puke, and he's just like, you know, it was just such a great like character moment for, you know, all the sort of turmoil that's like roiling up inside him.
At one point you're gonna break, right? You're just gonna you can't stand, you have no more strength, it's all gonna go away. You can hold it together for a while, yeah, but we're human, you know.
Well, and it's like, you know, that there's the stress of losing his child, but then also like the guilt,
yeah, he's holding
of what he's doing, and he the whole time he keeps saying like everything they're doing is wrong, and but he keeps going through with it. And you know, then Viola Davis like learns, and she's like, "What the hell were you thinking? All right, take me to him. I'm yeah, gonna try to get it out of him."
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
Like, and then she joins the party too, like, of trying to torture this guy. Now she was trying to, coax it out of him through kindness or whatever, but
she took a different approach. Yeah,
didn't work out, and then you know, it also resulted in more torture.
Please help me. Can you help me find my little girl? Got a picture. This is my baby. Her name is Joy. And this is the stuffed animal we got when she was two because she's afraid to sleep by herself. Please tell me where my little girl is. Please tell me where my little girl is.
But how great was that scene where it's like, okay, we set up, you know, the Hugh Jackman character. The very, very opening shot in the woods, they're hunting. He's like, you know, doing the Lord's Prayer or whatever before his son like shoots the deer. And then
always over prepare and that speech.
Well, so right before that, he's just, you know, reciting a prayer before they shoot the deer.
Oh, yep.
And then later he's trying to do that same Lord's Prayer while he's got Paul Dano in the like, the hot water, cold water torture chamber, and he's like slumped down in the doorway, you know, trying to give this whole prayer, and it's like he gets to the part where he's supposed to say and forgive those who trespass against us, and he can't get it out because like of what he's doing, and like the part that that he's supposed to be following that advice of, he can't follow, and like he can't even say that thing.
Your sister, you have to deliver. Forgive us our trespasses. As we
prisoners, I mean, I feel like that was the first time that most Americans, you know, or non art house. a film goers got to see anything by Denis Villeneuve, and you know, he had done three movies in French before this, and then I guess as we talked about with Enemy, it's like he kind of shot Enemy and then this back to back, and then Enemy I think came out first but no one saw it, and then this was kind of a bigger film, and It's such a like a big way to be introduced to the a wider audience, and like and you can see how like a lot of these elements in here kind of helps translate into the things where, you know, now he's doing these huge movies, and like, you know, even bigger movies on the scale of Sicario and even Arrival, which isn't that much bigger but still a little bigger than this one.
Yeah.
And then all the way up to, like, you know, Dune, right?
Yeah.
But you see how, like, in that, like, him not backing away from those character moments in here, but also, you know, approaching everything with a lot of style with, you know, the music. And then we talked about the cinematography a little bit, the Roger Deakins stuff. You know, he's worked with Roger Deakins a whole bunch, and that was, you know, this collaboration that he's continued. But, you know, you just see right out of the gate that, like, there's this sort of a vision and the way he approaches things that, like, it's not your average sort of rinse and repeat director. But, and it's not surprising that this has, like, helped him sort of launch that part of his career.
Hello again.
Hey, I was hoping you'd let me do some penance.
For what?
For scaring you the other day, the police station.
You already apologized for that.
I know, I was, you know, I thought maybe you could use some help around the, you know, I noticed your door here needs fixing, so I brought my tools and,
Yeah. I see. I'm glad you want to talk some more. No need to make excuses. You Come on in and make me a cup of tea.
We were talking about Roger Deakins earlier, and I meant to bring this up because, like, but you were kind of on a roll, so I didn't stop you, and then I forgot about it. But, like, wanted to mention the cinematographer on The Ice Storm. And, you know, as we were talking about this film block at the sort of Hannah and her sister's screening the other day, they were talking about how The Ice Storm was just so, like, beautifully filmed, and of course it was, and, you know, especially when we actually see the ice part of The Ice Storm. And the cinematographer, I went to, like, look up what he'd worked on, and, you know, he'd done a whole bunch of stuff, and he kind of came up with David Lynch, you know, so he was, like, shooting Eraserhead, like, all the way back, right?
Oh.
And then, you know, he shot a bunch of stuff for, you know, Jim Jarmusch. He did the HBO thing The Night Of, like, you know, so he's got a whole bunch on his, under his belt.
Frederick Elms?
Yes, Frederick Elms is his name. And then, but one of the things that he did earlier on, which was interesting, was he shot The River's Edge, which was the Tim Hunter written and directed movie. And Tim Hunter is good friends with Patrick Cady. Tim Hunter also owned the print of Hannah and Her Sisters, which we ended up watching with Patrick. So there
you go. This is our 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
6 degrees of Patrick Cady. So anyway, thanks again, Tim, and thanks again, Patrick, for helping screen this one and put it together.
Thank you so much.
A whimpering, simpering child again, bewitched, bothered, and bewildered.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I think by the time you're listening to this, it should have already been or is Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving. I'm putting that on the editor for this one.
Yeah, hopefully we're hearing this right before Thanksgiving, and you're just about to sit down to your turkey roll.
I hope so. Next up, obviously, we're going to be moving on to Christmas movies, but we're going to be doing some low-key Christmas movies where Christmas only plays a background role.
Detective low-key?
Detective low-key. we're going to be watching Gremlins from 1984, Batman Returns from 1992, and Catch Me If You Can from 2002. What a block. This will be a fun block. This will actually put a smile on our face.
Yeah, it'll be a little less stressful than the Thanksgiving block. And, you know, they're also, you know, when you go to sit down and watch Christmas movies, sometimes you want to watch Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life and Home Alone and some of these Christmas Vacation and all these Christmas classics. And sometimes you want to do something a little more low-key, and that's what we're having in mind here. So.
What are you?
All right, thank you so much for listening. Please make sure to subscribe and follow us on all the podcasts and social platforms at the Grindhouse Institute. And if you really want to give us a boost, check us out on Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and review. It helps us to get noticed. Thanks so much, everybody. We will be back next week.
Ciao.
Millions of books written on every conceivable subject by all these great minds, and in the end, none of them knows anything more about the big questions of life than I do. And Nietzsche, with his theory of eternal recurrence, he said that the life we live, we're going to live over and over again the exact same way for eternity. Great. That means I'll have to sit through the ice capades again.